Hi everyone, welcome to the Tech Entrepreneur on a Mission podcast. My name is Ton Dobbe and I'm the founder of Value Inspiration and the author of The Remarkable Effect. I envision a world where every B2B SaaS startup succeeds because they're creating software that customers would miss if they were gone. And here's why. Research consistently shows that 90% of all startups fail, and that's bad. What's worse, however, is that 75% of SaaS scale-ups fail, companies that are supposed to have product market fit. Far too few scale-ups create the traction they aspire for and fail for the wrong reasons. And I believe this should stop, and hence I created my business. And the goal that I have with this podcast is twofold. First, to inspire new forms of value creation by sharing compelling ideas and stories about the potential that we can unlock when technology and people blend in the right way. Secondly, share experiences from tech entrepreneurs like you about what it requires to create a remarkable software business and how to overcome the roadblocks to do so. The guest on my podcast today is Jay Bartow, co-founder and CEO of Zeitworks.
Part of the differentiation, again, is just that this is a really hard problem. Every customer has idiosyncrasies in their processes and the applications they use to complete their processes. So that iterative process of getting data, getting new data from new customers, adjusting the technology, adjusting the product, it's something that can take years to do. Anyone else who's starting to work on this problem today has to go through this, you know, arduous R&D to figure out, how do I take all this, you know, crazy data and turn it into something useful?
This is Jay. He's a serial technology entrepreneur and innovator with 20 years of experience building startups from the ground up. He's a creative risk taker and passionate about developing and vetting ideas, providing vision and strategy, and building high-performing teams. Since June 2021, Jay is the CEO of Zeitworks. It's built around the idea that teams in every company execute thousands of repetitive processes every day, but are challenged to understand how work really gets done because their managers don't have visibility into these complex workflows. And this is what Zeitworks is solving, by building a fitness tracker for your people, processes, and productivity. Their belief? In the age of artificial intelligence, the value of human capital has never been more important. And this inspired me, and hence I invited Jay to my podcast. We explore what is broken in the way that businesses are leveraging automation. Jay explains that before you can automate something, you have to understand it. And that's exactly where most companies go dark. He shares his big lessons learned to create defensible differentiation, and what threat he's constantly looking for to build a business that grows predictable traction from the start. By listening to this podcast, you will learn four things. Firstly, what to focus on to create a SaaS business that's got staying power. Secondly, why the real value is not in automation, but in augmentation. Thirdly, why transparency should be higher on your list of value drivers. And lastly, what mindset to train if you want to accelerate your SaaS business. Well, hi, Jay. Thank you for making the time available and being the guest today on the podcast.
Hi, Ton. Great to meet you. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, well, it was a pleasure. The moment I got approached by one of your members, your team members, about like what Zeitworks is doing, I looked at the website, looked at the about, and I was like, yep, that's going to be another one. Awesome. It fits really, really well with the purpose that I have of the podcast, which is, as you say on your website, maximizing human potential. Yeah, using technology in such a way that it blends with people and it allows people to do things they've never been able to do before, rather than just automating things out of a way. Very interesting to understand like what mission Zeitworks is on. But before we dig into that, if you would describe yourself as an entrepreneur, two or three characteristics, what would they be?
Well, let's see. I think a really important characteristic of being an entrepreneur is being creative and really wanting to build things is really important. Me and everybody on our team is, you know, we want to make new things and, you know, bring new technology to market, bring new products to market. That creativity, obviously it's technical creativity and product creativity, but that's a huge part of, you know, I think of my entrepreneurship. And then, you know, I would say, you know, technology in general is a big part of it too. You know, I got interested in machine learning and data in the late 90s during the dot-com boom. And I've done a number of companies since that kind of, you know, run this like data and machine learning playbook, either for businesses or for consumers in a number of different verticals and spaces: travel, e-commerce, online advertising, medical informatics. So I didn't plan it this way, but there's so much data out there. And figuring out how to wrangle it and use the latest machine learning technologies and analytics technologies to pull value out of that data is hard to do. And so those challenging problems are really a deep part of my entrepreneurship.
Cool. We're still a real entrepreneur on the machine learning side then. Good. All right. Well, talking about Zyteworks, on your website, it says that you joined June 2021, but there's a sort of a story before that. My first question would be, what was the problem that you saw that was screaming for a solution, and how did it all start for you?
Yeah, no, it's an interesting story. So I have been a serial technology entrepreneur in Seattle for 20 plus years and have co-founded 4 startups during that time, all venture capital backed. But in 2016, I joined a startup studio in Seattle called Madrona Venture Labs, funded by the largest venture capital group in the Pacific Northwest, Madrona Venture Group. And it was a pretty cool gig. You know, a few of us, handful of us that are experienced operators and entrepreneurs worked in this lab. And our charter was to think up cool, new, venture backable technology startup ideas. Just go out in the world, talk to people, think up new ideas. And then very importantly, do our research and homework on those ideas. We all knew from being experienced entrepreneurs and from working with a lot of entrepreneurs in the community that, you know, again, entrepreneurs are passionate, creative people. And when they think up an idea, they're like, wow, this is a great idea. And then they ask their friends and family and they're like, what do you guys think of this idea? And typically the response is, yeah, that's a great idea. You should go do that. But not all ideas are created equal. Some ideas are good ideas and other ideas, maybe not so good ideas. And so a lot of entrepreneurs, unfortunately, don't realize that an idea is good or bad until well into the execution of the idea.
Yeah.
And if you're a year or two in and you realize, you know, hey, this market isn't as big as I thought it was, or the customer demand for this product isn't what I thought it was, or a number of other assumptions and things that can go sideways, then you could find yourself in big trouble. So what we would do at the startup studio at Madrona Venture Labs is we'd come up with these ideas. But then we would do our homework and go talk to customers, go talk to industry experts, go talk to lots of venture capitalists and find out, like, is this really a good idea? And our thesis was that 9 out of 10 ideas are bad ideas.
Let me make a small interruption here. Jay just made an excellent remark about what's a critical process to go through before you double down on building a remarkable SaaS business. Instead of trying to find arguments why your idea is a good idea, shake the tree hard and find all the arguments why it's a bad idea. If it proves hard to kill it, then you're onto something big. It's a trait remarkable SaaS companies master. They focus on the essence and then search for the opportunities to create new value possibilities that are both mission critical and desirable. And you can master these traits as well. The first step? Simply download my book. I've made the electronic version available for free. Just visit theremarkableeffect.com to grab your copy, and inspiration will spark in the next 10 minutes. Back to the interview.
It may sound good, but you know, you really should shake the tree hard. And so our goal was to kill most of the ideas. The more we could come up with and the more we could kill, that was really kind of what we were trying to maximize. And then the good ideas, we would look for entrepreneurs to work on them with us. And then we would help them build MVPs and go get pilot customers and then ultimately raise a seed round of financing so that they could spin out of the lab and go off on their own and flap their wings wildly and try to make a go of it. That's kind of my career leading up to the Zyteworks project.
So within the Zyteworks, well, within the lab that you were part of, the idea around Zyteworks started to be created. You were involved in the ID creation, but you didn't start to execute it from the start.
Yeah. So typically what we would do is, you know, once we decided we had a good idea, then a few of us would actually start working on the idea, maybe build a prototype or test, get some data and test out some technology, start to hire a few people to come in and help us. And so Zyteworks in the, this is probably late 2018, Madrona Venture Group, the venture capital group that funded us, they got really interested in RPA, robotic process automation. Companies like UiPath and Automation Anywhere and Blue Prism and lots of automation companies out there But at that time, those companies were really like blowing up in a big way. They're really turning into unicorns overnight. And so, you know, that excites venture capitalists. This is a hot area. And so they said to us, go look at the RPA space, you know, learn about what's going on there and see if there's anything interesting to do there downstream or upstream, or come back and tell us where you think the market is going to go over the next, you know, 3 to 5 years. Mm-hmm. And so I personally didn't know a lot about RPA. I had heard of it from a friend of mine who worked in insurance and said, you know, insurance companies are starting to use this technology. But, you know, in our usual methodical fashion, we started talking to vendors and then we started talking to customers. And then actually, we also ended up talking to a lot of management consulting groups, the Deloittes and McKinsey's and EY's of the world, who play a big role in this space.
Yeah,
and what we found was there's a lot of desire to automate highly repetitive work. People processing insurance claims or bank loans or onboarding HR, you know, flows and work and that kind of stuff. Some of it very much requires a human because the AI technology is not good enough to analyze a document or an image or something. But a lot of it is really repetitive. And people would be better served, you know, rising up a level and doing higher level cognitive tasks rather than this very low level rote work. And that was one of the reasons why RPA was taking off. But what we found was before you can automate something, you have to understand it. So say you have a bank loan, say you have 50 people doing a bank loan, and you're like, well, you know, boy, it'd be great to automate some of the pieces of it. Well, which pieces? And what surprised us as we dug and started, you know, with talking to these three different constituent groups, consultants, customers, and RPA vendors, was that more often than not, organizations don't know what the process is. They maybe had a standard operating procedure at one point, but over time, it just kind of got washed away. Attrition, changes in the business, all kinds of reasons. Something that may have started out methodical with some specific directions on how to do things ended up kind of being chaos, organized chaos. And so a lot of people embarked on RPA projects that ultimately failed because the processes they were trying to automate were either too complex or just not well understood enough. We thought, well, that's interesting. That sounds like a real problem. And then the clincher was we went and talked to, as I mentioned earlier, a bunch of consulting groups. And they said, oh, yeah, we've got a solution to that problem. We help all kinds of companies discover and analyze their processes, their repetitive processes. And we were like, great, how do you do that? Well, we bring in a whole bunch of young college grads who come in and they stand over the shoulders of the people doing their work. They do these discovery workshops. They have notepads, they have stopwatches, and they write this stuff all down manually. And over some period of days and weeks, pull all the data together, the sticky notes and the stopwatch timings, and sort of create a path flow or canonical flow of what the process is. And that's when we really had the epiphany for Zyteworks. We were like, wow. That sounds really time consuming. That sounds expensive. That sounds error prone. Yep. It's only a one point in time analysis as well. So we thought, why not do that with technology? Why not have a piece of software that lives on a desktop computer and passively observes nonstop how agents, SMEs, whatever you want to call them, interact with their applications on their desktop as they go about their daily work? And take all of that data, all those observations, all those mouse clicks and keyboard clicks and windows coming to the foreground and background, all of that interactive event stream data, as we call it, and then use machine learning technology, steal out of that very rich and noisy data what's actually going on, what are the patterns, and since we're observing people doing the work, ultimately figure out, you know, who's doing a good job, who's efficient, who's inefficient. For the efficient people, what are their primary behaviors that make them efficient? And can you share those primary behaviors with the people who are less efficient? All kinds of things like that.
Very interesting. I mean, I had an idea about where this would go, but this is a new angle again to me. So it's sort of in the middle between the kind of what can you automate and how can you lift human potential in that whole process? And you can go two ways with that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it's interesting because a lot of the media talks about AI in a kind of black and white way. Like AI is going to replace you in your job. AI is autonomous truck driving is going to replace truck drivers, you know, et cetera, et cetera. I think, you know, AI is best when it's assisting or augmenting a human being, and that there's a human in the loop versus this sort of like Skynet is going to like take over the world and everybody's going to lose their jobs and we're all going to get screwed.
Same for me. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So I think, you know, business process execution is very similar. Sometimes I'll use an analogy of autonomous driving, you know, where you need humans, but it's also nice if the technology can do some work for you too. I have a Tesla, and because I'm a geek, I got the cheapest Tesla, but I bought the full self-driving package. I fell for Elon's, you know, sales messaging on, you know, autonomous driving, and this was the greatest thing. And so I bought the car about 2 years ago, and I'm driving it on the highway, and I turn on the autopilot, and I'm like, wow, this is really cool. This is great. I'm just going to kind of sit back and enjoy the ride. They make you keep your hands on the steering wheel, though, but it was pretty impressive. Then when we got back into the city, I saw my life flash in front of my eyes. Suddenly the car is headed straight for a median, and it clearly doesn't see the things that I'm seeing and is not, you know, doing what I would hope it would do. I grab the wheel, take back control over the car, and then, you know, continue driving to safety. And I think that's a great example of how there's work to be done by the AI. They can be very helpful, long trips on highways and so forth. At least right now, I hope it'll get better. But in the city, you better have your hands on the wheel. And so I think that that's that way, same kind of thing with a lot of business work. The key is the handoff back and forth between the AI and the human. And getting that part right, I think as a society, we're just kind of starting to figure out how to do that. Whether it's with, you know, autonomous driving or whether it's, you know, sitting at our desks and doing our jobs.
Yeah, exactly. So what do you believe is the opportunity if we get this right, like this, the blend of this?
Well, you know, I think it really follows a long human civilization pattern of technology helping us and making things easier for us. You know, if you go back only as far as even, say, the Industrial Revolution, where suddenly you had steam tractors and you didn't need, you know, oxen and plows and, you know, people walking the fields, suddenly I can do a lot more work, you know, with my steam tractor. I still have to drive it, but now I have more time to increase the volume of my productivity. I can get more done for less and focus on higher level cognitive tasks. And so, you know, if you go back to the Stone Age, you know, you can see this evolution and pattern playing out over, you know, thousands of years. I think what's a little bit different now that I think we're all kind of trying to figure out how this is going to work is that the acceleration of technology capabilities is at a point of inflection where it's not, you know, the oxen and steam tractor happened over a generation. This stuff's happening over a few years.
Exactly.
And so we really got to kind of hold on tight, I think, to, you know, watch this evolution now, this pattern we've seen over thousands of years now happen much more quickly.
Yep. Completely agree with that one. So if I understand well, I mean, there's a lot of automation going on. Your solution sits sort of in the area whereby you're looking for areas to automate, and then it brings together all the information, informs the people that are responsible for this, like augment them in terms of the intelligence, where the big opportunities are to create leverage through automation, right?
Yeah, it's actually not just automation. Automation is just one of the pillars for us. Mm-hmm. Just having insight and transparency into what your team is doing and what's going on with your, not just your processes, but your employees as well, is a big part of the value we offer. And the efficiencies that come from the transparency and analytics we offer, some of it can be automation. Like, hey, here's a place in this process where people copy and paste a dozen values from a Salesforce window into Excel. You should automate that. But, you know, here's also behaviors we see across the team that may be suboptimal, and behaviors that, if corrected with better training or change in habits, a reference process written down that people are following that's known to be efficient. There's a lot of optimizations and savings there as well.
Exactly. And that's at the end, like the part where human potential can really take it to the next level. Because if you, like you say on your website, let's face it, You can't fix it if you can't see it. And now you enable people to see it. I like that. And typically in larger distributed organizations, I recently had an example, for example, of BMW. I think it was the BMW that, of course, have a global organization and there's people selling cars. And some people are doing a real good job and some people are maybe doing a less good job. But like, what is that secret? What do these do people do different? And start to understand the patterns on this without having to go and just follow 30,000 salespeople around the world. That's an interesting thing in itself. So you were at this lab, the idea got created, the prototypes were being built, and then you took over being the CEO in June 21, correct?
That's correct.
Yeah. So what was the stage that you started to become responsible for the company and started to run it like as the CEO as you are right now?
Yeah. After the company spun out of the lab and raised a seed round of financing with a great CEO we found, a guy named Ryan Windham, you know, they started really trying to work on the problem of taking this, again, very heterogeneous, voluminous, noisy data that's collected, watching how people interact with their applications and distilling the facts out of the data, the patterns that are business relevant. And it, you know, it turns out that's a really hard problem. It really is not that surprising that it's a hard problem in that, you know, real world data is often very difficult to work with. It's noisy, it's missing values, it's lopsided. And a lot of machine learning and data science is really around taking raw data, raw business data, and massaging it and building features from it and all kinds of things, which is part science and part art.
Yeah.
And so Zeitworks is no exception. A lot of the technology that we built is around massaging that data so that we can run the machine learning algorithms on it. And so there were some fits and starts on the right way to do this. And again, this is in 2020. So the pandemic was raging and I think everybody was sort of running under couches and tables and figuring out kind of, you know, what to do and how to do things. And then Ryan had some personal issues come up, you know, that he needed to deal with. And so given that I was sort of still on the sidelines as an advisor, feeling very kind of emotionally attached to the company and idea since I came up with it with my co-founder, another guy named Ben Elowitz, I wanted to see it keep going. And so the board, who I knew very well, said to me, you know, hey, why don't you come run this? Given that it's such a difficult technical problem, maybe, you know, the first person who, you know, tries to get this spun up and into the air should be maybe more on the technical side.
Yeah.
And then if we can find a technical solution that scales, then, you know, there's maybe a more traditional business appropriate CEO then that could come back in. And so this sounded like a good challenge to me. I had been at the lab for almost 5 years at that point, and I thoroughly enjoyed the lab and the work that I did there, but I was kind of ready to operate again. You know, ultimately, I'm an operator. I got to kind of play a venture capitalist a little bit at the lab, and that was fun, but yeah, I like to build stuff. So I came in and joined as CEO. There were just a few people in the company at the time. There was the piece of software that we put on the desktop machine. We had an early version of that software and one pilot customer. And so that's kind of where we started. And, you know, again, our CTO, Kalpana Narayanaswamy, is great and had lots of great ideas on how to do this. We put our heads together. We started hiring people. And now 18 months later, you know, we're up and going and have a handful of pilot customers, have a lot of positive feedback. We're getting close to product market fit. And, you know, watching the space evolve too has been really interesting over the last several years.
Exactly.
Terms like hyper automation or intelligent automation, which includes not just RPA, but also process mining, which is a technology and tool that mines log files, processes that are executed within enterprise systems like ERP systems and CRM systems. It's kind of a special kind of process. That's a field that's been growing. AI and ML is affecting all this stuff. And then there's another term called task mining, which generally applies to doing what we do on the desktop. So instead of mining log files from large enterprise servers, you know, we're going after a harder problem, which is, you know, people who are using desktop applications, web apps, productivity apps like Microsoft Office. You know, most of our customers use Excel in some shape or form as glue between the different pieces of the process. So we went after this problem and it's, you know, generally referred to as task mining. We try to avoid that term a little bit just because we offer a lot more than some of the task mining features that are available on some other intelligent automation platforms, but it's been interesting to watch this space grow.
Yeah. Well, that brings me to a question, like, yeah, how do you scope for this? Because, you know, there's so much technology out there. What was a critical decision that you took early on in order to get you on the right path to create something that has defensible differentiation?
Well, I think part of the differentiation, again, is just that this is a really hard problem. And so there's, you know, we've spent a lot of time, you know, on kind of pure R&D, trying different techniques, getting different data sets from different customers is a really important part of what we do. Because, you know, every customer has idiosyncrasies in their processes and the applications they use to complete their processes. So that iterative process of getting data, getting new data from new customers, adjusting the technology, adjusting the product, it's something that can take years to do. And, you know, I would say our moat is really around that kind of linear execution of that R&D work. You know, anyone else who's starting to work on this problem today has to go through this, you know, arduous R&D to figure out, how do I take all this, you know, crazy data and turn it into something useful? I think that's certainly a big part of it.
Yeah, cool. And what you mentioned, there's different point solutions to go about this. There's on the one hand side, of course, RPA. Then there is, like you said, process mining. Then there's task mining solutions. What made you come up with, okay, what needs the scope? The scope, of course, needs to be something that's useful for customers in order to solve the problem, maybe end to end.
So a big part of our philosophy is continuous improvement. And yeah. So, you know, you can, you know, if you're familiar with methodologies like Lean or Six Sigma, or these different improvement methodologies, you know, a lot of that stuff applies to stuff from factories, and methodologies from those sectors apply to this world as well. And so we strongly believe that improving your processes, maximizing the human potential of your team, is an iterative experimental process that happens over time. And so you start by getting a baseline. Okay, I don't know what my folks do. Give me some data that shows me what they do. Okay, now I can see, well, you know, here's a part of the process I think we should rethink, because it seems kind of convoluted. And I'm noticing from the Zeitworks data that everybody does it a little bit differently. So let's start there. Let's start making some changes, come up with some hypotheses, make some changes, put it into production, run it for a while, then measure the differences in deltas from the baseline, see those results, set a new baseline, and then rinse and repeat.
Exactly.
And so this continuous improvement cycle, I think, is really important part of, you know, you hear so much about companies trying to leverage data, you know, and how data is the new oil. And so I think a lot of organizations are still trying to figure out, okay, well, when I get some data, what should I do? And I feel like continuous improvement is sort of the next step of how I take that data and then very methodically, you know, use it to improve my business.
Yeah. Do you then, with the outcome of that, give the people, what type of advice do you give people? Is it purely insights into what's happening? Or do you also say, okay, well, we see bottlenecks here, start there, for example?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, you know, we certainly started with a lot of descriptive statistics and metrics. And so, again, given that people, most of our customers really had no idea about a lot of elements of their operations team and the processes, starting out by showing them, like, hey, did you know that, you know, a lot of time is spent in this part of the process and less time is spent in that in the part of the process? Did you know that most of your employees use these half dozen applications, but then there are these other applications that other people use for some reason? And when you point it out to people, they're like, those are legacy applications. They shouldn't be using those. We sunsetted those a long time ago. Or we'll point out, like, hey, there's a few people here using Notepad to copy values from different places and as sort of a note-taking thing. Really? I had no idea anybody was using Notepad really as part of the process. So that kind of transparency into the black box, I think, is sort of the first wave of functionality that we built. Now we're starting to build like calculators and simulators. And so, like, think about like financial portfolio optimization, where you have a number of financial instruments and you're trying to optimally distribute your resources across those instruments to maximize your output. The problem is similar for these operations groups. I've got 20 people, you know, performing this loan application process. They're all good at different things. Some are good at some things, some are better than other things. So help me figure out, like, what's an optimal distribution of work across those folks in order to maximize, you know, the output, maximize my capacity, limit costs, all those kinds of things. Even simple things like running little backtesting experiments where, say, you know, the goal is to drive down the average time spent in a particular part of the process, and you have some ideas on what to do there, but you want to be able to know, like, hey, if I was able to save 15% time with people in this part of the process, how much money would I save? Yeah. And so given the historical data that we have, it's easy to backtest and run those hypotheses and see that, wow, you know, if I change this, I could save, you know, X thousands of dollars, where if I change that Y, I could save 2X those values. So maybe I'll start there.
Exactly. That's all about prioritization again. And that's where it gets really, really interesting. What has been the hardest nut to crack in this process?
You know, again, I think it goes back to the raw data and that kind of classic problem of, you know, trying to take data and get the signal out of it so that machine learning algorithms can do their thing. You know, a lot of young people go into data science and machine learning, and they're really excited to build models and train models, especially the latest one, neural networks and, you know, these deep networks and so forth. Very, very exciting stuff. But the reality is that, you know, your average data scientist, you know, does spend a majority of their time, I'll just say that, you know, massaging data, cleaning up data, running transforms on data in order to really understand, like, where is the signal here? And that was particularly challenging with Zeitworks. And we've really been working on that for a couple of years now. We're in a great place with those abilities now. There's always still more to do.
Of course.
You know, we do have a human in the loop that helps during this process as we train our models and make sure we're distilling the right data. Ultimately, we want to automate as much of that as we can. So there's always work to do.
Fascinating. So what I've heard earlier in the call is that you got pilot customers, you're running towards product market fit. What have you learned in the period right now that you've started to go to market? Is this something that's an easy sell? Is it something whereby you have to educate people? Are there people that just grab it out of your hands because this is what they've been waiting for?
Yeah, great question. I mean, I think that most people we talk to get it, you know, right off the bat. You know, they don't have any information. Zeitworks provides them with that information. And so, you know, it's easy to understand the value proposition. I think there, you know, one of the things that we're learning is that, and this is, I think, a really important component of our product, is that it's not just about the process and it's not just about the people. It's really the fact that the people and the process are inextricably tied and intertwined. And so, you know, coming up with the right metrics that describe how people interact with the process is really how we're tuning things. A lot of the other technologies and products I mentioned earlier are really focused just on the process.
Yeah, exactly.
Process mining, for example, is kind of a backward-looking technology that looks at patterns from large enterprise systems, as I mentioned.
Yeah.
But there's not a lot about, you know, how people interacted with those processes and what their behaviors are. So we really bring both together. But, you know, we're just starting to really figure out how to do that well. And there's certainly more work to do there, but it's really about both of those people and processes.
Yeah, and I completely get that. And that's also what inspired me when I saw the first site. It was not only about process. It was not only about automation. It's the combination of like how people fit in that in the best possible way, making people doing the things that they were actually created to do for.
Yeah.
Looking at the time at the moment, you being a serial entrepreneur, I said to you, I think you've founded 4 companies. I wrote my book, The Remarkable Effect, which is about like what are the things that companies that we start talking about and keep talking about do a little bit different. What have you learned over time to create a software business that creates a lasting impact and an impact that people talk about?
Well, if you look carefully at some of the companies I've co-founded, there is a thread that runs through many of them. And I've used this word earlier in our conversation. It's a transparency thread. And so one of the earliest companies I co-founded was called Ad Relevance. And it was during the .com era when online advertising was just getting started. And I got connected to an advertising executive who came from traditional media, who explained to me and some of our other co-founders, when people run advertising campaigns and pay for advertising campaigns, they want to know what the competition is doing. So if you're working on a campaign for Toyota, I mean, you want to run a TV ad. Well, you want to know, like, what's Mitsubishi doing or what's Nissan doing? And where are they spending? Well, in the late 90s, none of this information was available for online advertising. And so our goal was to build technology that would scour the web looking for advertisements, classifying them, recording where we found them, and paint a picture of the advertising metrics landscape. And we were the first people to do this. And so, you know, people loved it because suddenly an ad buyer could go and look and say, where is my competition advertising on what sites? And can I go there and advertise alongside them or go to different sites or whatever? And so that was sort of the first kind of transparency play I worked on. Actually, I'm not sure that's entirely true. But what I learned quickly was that when you provide transparency for people with data, quite often there's people who like it and don't like it. There's oftentimes legacy industries that make money or have leverage from the lack of transparency. And it turns out back in the late 90s, Yahoo in particular didn't like what we were doing. They were the king of the hill at the time. They were one of the biggest advertisers, not only on the web, but on their site as well. And suddenly we were giving away transparency to small mom and pop shops and anybody who wanted to know what was going on. And so they took issue. Really quick, another company I co-founded was called Faircast. And Faircast was the idea of a computer science professor, well-known guy in town here in Seattle, Oren Etzioni, early machine learning guy. He had the idea that, hey, you know, every time I fly from Seattle to Los Angeles to visit, you know, my family member, I pay a different price. Why is that? Well, it turns out we know why it is. The airlines use revenue management systems to maximize the price of a ticket, to sell the right ticket to the right person at the right time.
Yeah.
You and I may both want to make that trip from Seattle to Los Angeles, but we have different price elasticity.
Yeah.
I want to travel for business, so I'm definitely going. I'm willing to pay more. You want to go for leisure, so you'll go if the price is right. And so the airlines have to optimize, you know, that. And so we built technology that reverse engineered those systems with machine learning technology to be able to predict if this was a good time to buy the ticket or not, and whether we thought the price was going to go down meaningfully in the near future and you should wait to buy.
Yeah.
And so, you know, people got this. It was like, yeah, this is cool. I like this. The airlines didn't like it.
Democratizing data. Yeah.
We were democratizing data. Exactly. Yeah. And so we did this with actually medical research literature too in another company. We did this with e-commerce earlier in the 90s with MetaSearch and MetaShopping. So there's definitely been a theme there in my career around that transparency. And as you say, democratizing data.
All right. Last question. From all the tidbits that you've gained over your entrepreneurial careers, what would be a do and what would be a don't that you would share with aspiring entrepreneurs or people that want to like take things to the next level?
Well, one of the do's is, you know, as I was talking about earlier, do your homework, be brave, go talk to people who might tell you your idea is not a good idea. You know, be open to feedback, you know, get any kind of information you can from anybody, you know, who will listen. That's hard. That's a really hard thing, I think, for just people in general to do, is be open to, you know, places where your idea, your go-to-market strategy, your product may have weaknesses. So definitely do that. And I guess really, you know, don't be in a shell. Don't build your company in a vacuum. Get out there, talk to people, be vulnerable, because this is, again, your creativity. This is your idea. This is something you deeply associate it with. And so to open it up for criticism and feedback is a very vulnerable thing that people need to do. And that takes strength.
Yeah, it does. It does. Well, thank you very much, Jay. Thank you for sharing the story. Fascinating idea that you're on, and definitely a lot of potential, I would guess, for so many companies out there to kind of blend process and people in the right possible way. Yeah, keep following you on your journey. And
thanks.
Good luck.
Thanks a lot, Tan. Great to meet you, and thanks for having me on.
It was a pleasure. And this ends my conversation with Jay, and I hope you enjoyed it. If so, please leave a review on iTunes. And if it inspired you, please share it with other tech entrepreneurs on a mission that you have in your network. Other than that, thank you for tuning into this podcast. I had the honor to speak to Jay Bartow, co-founder and CEO of Zitworks. As said, the goal that I have in this podcast is twofold. Firstly, to inspire new forms of value creation by sharing compelling ideas and stories about the potential we can unlock when technology and people blend in the right way. And secondly, share experiences from tech entrepreneurs like you about what is required to create a remarkable software business and how to overcome the roadblocks to do so. Before I close, I have two more comments to make. If you know other tech entrepreneurs on a mission that have a story worth sharing, please send me an email at ton.dobby@valueinspiration.com. Building the momentum all starts with revealing the ideas, and that starts with you. And if you want to know more about my book, or you're interested in joining the Remarkable Effect tribe, please visit my website at www.valueinspiration.com. Thanks for tuning in. And you could do me a big favor by rating the podcast on iTunes or provide me with your feedback directly. I'll see you shortly on a new episode.
Coming up on 5 Minute News, I'm Anthony Davis. You might think it's partisan because maybe it's critical of one side or the other, but it's not, it's just the truth. And I think that's also something that's kind of unusual for Americans listening to the radio or to podcasts, because the news landscape in the States has been so partisan for so many decades. So 5 Minute News is verified, truthful, independent, unbiased, and essential world news daily.